Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boileau, co-host of Epis Radio, sitting in the studio with Nazarita Goldhammer, our other co-host. It is March 12th, 2009, and we are moving forward with our impromptu segment entitled Junctures Part 6, Being and Having and the Possessive Self. We started this discussion last week about being and having, and we have talked for a long time about the possessive self. We've written books on it. And if you think of it like this, that in each historical epic, we have a certain way of thinking about the self. And in fact, in some cultures, maybe we didn't really think about the self at all. There was a time, if you study super ancient Greece, Neapolitan, pre-Socratic, what I call the Apollonian pre-Socratic time period. If you look at the Iliad and the Odyssey, there's no real, unless I'm dead wrong, there's no textual evidence of a reflective self, a self that reflects. And so people acted based upon rules and prescriptions, and you achieved successes and esteem, learning the rules really well, and being able to execute them with excellence. A period of, the deepening self, the idea that the self was this deep, dark, vast something, or rather, and we can scrutinize it. And that's why Jung became so popular, because there's no end to this pursuit. It gives people something to do with their time and their imagination. This is why Freud became so important. But one might argue that it's culturally, historically specific. Then, if you think about Western Enlightenment, and we're dominated by Western culture, and this is where we are, so we're going to largely interpret in terms of Western thought these issues. We became, in the Enlightenment in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, enamored with this objective world. We could go out and find it and discover it and do things with it. And we then decided we were going to put the focus of that light on ourselves. And so humans being what they are, they end up developing all kinds of complex languages about this thing called the self. And one of them happens to be psychoanalysis, or critical theory, or existential phenomenology, psychologies, philosophies of the self. And there's evidence that in the modern self there are topological algorithms for a self-structure. So if you take a snapshot of any one culture in history, you might be able to describe it and describe the self-positions within that matrix of selves. That makes sense. There's nothing mystical about that. It's just an analytic method. And we could also say that these topological possibilities transform through time. Now we're in a period in which capitalism has fortified itself so much that with a competitive economy of capitalism, we have what I call the possessory self. This is the main archetype of the self. It's an arche. It's an overarching topology of the self. It's the possessive self, the self that possesses everything, including itself. I have my body. And in an ontological critique, we don't really have anything. We just are. We exist. We have values. And that, we'll call it a primordial ontological analytic. In that region, we can make ask questions and make judgments about what kind of self topology or self matrix we want in a culture. We could do that if we were thoughtful enough. We could do that. We're not doing that so intentionally right now, except in terms of capitalism. Here's an example. We see the human body, humans, as mechanisms that we can control through ideology and through the pharmacological psychiatric industries, where we manage people's perceptions that they're not well. It's all hermeneutic. It's interpretive. They might be perfectly fine, but we can dupe people into thinking that they're sick and manage them. And in turn, that becomes a fulcrum of governmental management of populations. So the only problem with analysis is that analysis was never intended to be an exhaustive account of the human condition. It's been tried, positive science tried. It's never worked out. And the reason for that is that the human being was born with a faculty of freedom and being able to cultivate possibilities and new horizons and transformational shifts, taking a perspective on oneself. Now, unfortunately, we're in a historical epic in which there is somewhat of a closure in these transcendent functions. And so the topology of the self, which is engineered by having or possession, is reigning supreme. It's a master signifier. Semiology of capitalism, semiology of possession, acquisition, having. And it's so dominant that other ways of interpreting our anthropology are suppressed. Interesting. So we can make judgments about this topology, right? We can talk about how people's moral behavior can become really horrible if the dominant value is possession. Talk about how average random people become complacent and desensitized to the real challenges of our global civilization, and all they're concerned with is their own money, their own comfortable little bourgeois lifestyle. People like that are really small-minded. They're little people, and they're immoral. They're actually immoral to stand by and be only concerned with your own fat little stomach. Is a moral catastrophe, and those people ought to be judged. They ought to be judged by a higher understanding of our human anthropology. They need to get off their complacent rear ends and get up and do something for somebody else. And I don't mean doing something for your niece or doing something for, you know, a family member. I'm talking about giving of yourself, making sacrifices in your own happiness to do something that is absolutely necessary for this world and this earth. And nobody else is going to do it. There are a lot of people who say, I'm glad somebody's doing that. I'm glad somebody's taking care of that. So that is an immature, self-deceptive frame of mind. The person saying those things is a child, at most a three-year-old. So number two, we begin to think about the world. If this is our topology of the self, we begin thinking about interrelationship solely in terms of instrumental value. The concept of love becomes distorted and has a dysmorphia in that love becomes instrumentalized in terms of money and possession, criteria, social advancement. So the idea of genuine caring for somebody and kindness becomes just a word in a book, and usually an older book. So value then becomes represented by efficiency, salary, GDP, functions that we perform to advance the possessory self system. That's what we've been talking about. Technology is number three. Technology is now technolatry, like idolatry. Now we have a technolatry. And we have people who are so enamored with the tech industry that they actually believe that technology is our liberation. Technology will yield valid knowledge. And we're fast in a situation where with robots and artificial intelligence that an overly complicated computerized everything for our homes and our cars, everything in our lives, that we become so dependent that we don't have any more time left in our very being to consider other things, other aspects about the human anthropology and the future of the human anthropology. Number four, this leads to a serious alienation from our healthy, natural, normal, temporal life. There becomes a distortion in temporality in such that we live in terms of a Google calendar or an Apple Watch or alarms that go off and on throughout the day with little reminders and signals. And we become so objectified that we lose our ability to constitute ourselves as moral agents. And we're choosing to do that. Now, most of the people who do that are not aware enough, and they're not intelligent enough to see that that's happening. They just go on living their complacent lives, making their little paycheck, buying their new car, getting their next house, taking their little trips, buying their clothes, and in fact, living as consumers of a culture that continues to destroy and exploit other humans and non-humans, clean water, and the earth. That's the situation. That's why we're talking about the dichotomy between being and having and the topology of the possessive self. And with that introduction, I would like to bring Nazarita into this discussion to hear her comments about this civilization of having and what we really lose in the moment of being with the pluripotentiality of so many creative ways of being and options for life and new ways to design who we are new ways to design our culture. We lose all that because we're dominated by a semiology of the possessive self. Nazarita, we're happy that you're on the show. We'd like to hear from you on this cult of having.
Thank you. What's really inspiring by what you're saying and also very troubling is that the cult of having in our current culture is like a selfie. We have entered into a time through capitalism that we want to be watched. We want to watch. We want to be tracked. We want to be, you know, in a really blatant word, stalked. We use social media for that. We use text for that. We use Instagram. We use Twitter. We use Snapchat. We are in the state of constantly having possession of someone's time. That means that whatever we do, someone can interrupt us in a moment. They can interrupt anything we're doing to possess our time. And I find this really, really interesting. I was reading a book recently on invisibility, and I was attracted to the title because it was intriguing that who wants to be invisible? Because we look at invisibility as something that is derogatory. Like, if we're invisible, nobody sees us, we are ignored, we are less. And we have taken that concept in our culture to the extreme to say only if we are seen through all these different social media methods, then we are worthwhile. Fame is only worthwhile if you're on every piece of social media to say that you are famous and that you have money and that you're in the news or you're constantly talked about, which is very fleeting. So what I read was shocking because I was reading that, you know, there are billboards that track cell phones in the area. So they know actually what area codes to send their marketing message to. That a stadium uses facial recognition so they can recognize the fans that come so they can market to them. That everywhere we go, we are tracked. We are tracked. We are watched. We are watching. We're in constant contact. And then part of what I was thinking is here's Venezuela, which has this supreme, huge power outage because of sabotage. And there is no water. There's no light. There's no technology. They're in the dark. And they're suffering. And this is the exact opposite of what our culture is immediately engrossed in, the cult of having another person. We have you. So let me just explore this, because this is really interesting. It concerns time, that if you're in the midst of doing something and you're engrossed, anyone could get a hold of you, because now we have cell phones, which are supremely important to our everyday life. Most people wouldn't be without their cell phones. To be in constant contact with those people that they love, that they feel close to, and yet those people can interrupt us to make sure where we are. They can track us. They can watch us. They can find out what we're doing at every single minute of the day, which creates the fallacy of a bond. It's a fallacy. It's not really a bond. It's a perverse way of tracking and stalking someone. Like, where are you? What are you doing? And then this constant conversation, which detracts really from where we are and what we're doing. And people would say in moderation. But if you walk down the street and you watch people that are gathered, 99% of them are on their cell phones. They're not with anyone. They're with the person on the phone. And I find this really interesting as we're talking about this possession. We are possessing a different time. We're not possessing the time that we're in. We're possessing someone else's time. We're engaged in this constant possession, which is, I think, an outgrowth of what our culture is engaged in now. It's that having. We have to have that contact. We have to have that watching. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the panopticon, or the surveillance society, is definitely an outgrowth of technology, raising technology to the status of a god. And it is the new god. Everything serves technology. And I think surveillance is a function of the governmentalization of populations. And so everything that you're reporting is an outgrowth of capitalism, the panopticon, the desire for population management. And this grows from a deep set of choices about how we're going to interpret temporality and how we're going to interpret self-structure. And we're going to see in this new economy of the self not a destruction of psychoanalysis, but a challenge to psychoanalysis. We're going to see a lot of corporations, a lot of governmentalizations, making various comments that it's unnecessary. You know, who needs to explore their deeper self? In reality, we can give people pills, we can make them fat with food, give them spectator sports for entertainment, the big screen TV, the foodie culture, the shiny new car, a nice new condo. So we can give people. So again, we're playing into the cult of having, and the bourgeoisie, in all of Western culture, if you read your history, which I have, plays a function. And the function is they're all self-deceptive. They're all narrow-minded. They're all children, and their sole function is to consume. It's consume as much as they can, and at the same time, operate as pawns in a system of production. Let's go further into this. There's another type or dimension of self-deception, and that has to do with creating abstract thought over concrete thought, abstract thought that is used in government manuals, healthcare manuals, corporate manuals. The paperwork is immense in corporations, healthcare, and governmental bureaucracy. These are three places. I mean, it's all digitalized now, but it is paperwork. It's rules and protocols. These abstract thinkings, which really don't have anything to do with concrete life, there's an alienation. It's called nothingness, the gap between abstract thinking and concrete living. And we've talked about this for quite some time. The fact that I can build a bomb in the Manhattan Project, and most people don't know why it was called the Manhattan Project. The bombs that we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were actually designed in Los Alamos, New Mexico. But it was called the Manhattan Project because the people ahead of the project had an office building in Manhattan in New York City. And there was this great clamor because there were enough bright, brilliant scientists who could, crank these mathematical equations to build a bomb. And so it was very abstract thinking, and nobody really thought about the concrete consequences of the bomb. We murdered huge amounts of people, huge numbers, and they're still suffering today. That's the concrete result. Or the abstract thinking in National Socialism in Germany, where, and I've read the manuals, you know, it was talked about abstractly, kind of the final disposition or the final solution is what it was called amongst the Nazis, and that was to murder 6 million Jewish people, which hurts my heart to even say. So, and here's some more examples. There now is an idiotic, really stupid debate about capitalism versus socialism. And first of all, most people have no idea what socialism means. They have no idea. They've not done the reading. They don't get it. Nor do they really understand capitalism. So there's this really stupid, watered-down debate on the internet about capitalism versus socialism. Those are just abstract words. And people will have all kinds of fanciful but false ideas about what they mean. And the truth is, right now we have an economy in the United States that is both capitalist and socialist. And 99% of the population doesn't get that. They really don't understand that. Here's a couple of examples. So, labor unions. Labor unions are not capitalist function. They're a socialist function. Labor unions have been the protections of workers for as long as we've had workers in the United States. The owners of production want to destroy labor unions. So there's a dialectic between labor unions and owners of production. So, but that is an example of how we have capitalism and we have socialism. Here's another one, communal living. When people, and I'm not talking about communes, I'm talking about retirement communities, the 55 and over set. They go and they buy a little condo, and they pay a little monthly fee, and they have everything delivered to them so that they can live this perceived happy life at the end of a mechanistic 40-year work period, kind of like they're out to farm, they're out to pasture. That is actually socialist because it's community. Here's another example. The drive towards universal health care. Medi-Cal in California is a largely a socialist medical system. So this is not a show on socialism or capitalism, but what people don't understand is when you live in this mode of having, and this is not easy to see, it's a challenging concept, we don't just have things and we don't just have people, but we can have ideas, we can possess ideas as abstract ideas that we use in an economy of instrumentalized thinking. Now, there's a subtle philosophical, logical move in that. But it is absolutely disastrous for most people to be thinking in that way. So getting back to the main line here, to move out of that mode of having means to move out of a mode of alienation. It means to move into concrete reality. And that means to move into the reality that we humans are destroying every day ecosystems, water, land, air, and animals. When you look at overly developed communities like, say, the Irvine area or Silicon Valley or parts of LA, where they're paved over with a lot of concrete and high-rise expensive buildings. Animals used to live there. When the city gets together and builds a 100-acre park with soccer fields and basketball courts, Where did the animals go? And I could give you 1,000 examples of those. So we do things, and the bourgeoisie does not want to take responsibility for all the destruction in this mode of having. We have a soccer field. We have built a great building. And unfortunately, in this mode of having, which is just, it's insane now, we're destroying everything in our wake. One of the examples is that is sea fish. There are a number of people, especially on the western coast of the United States, who were proud to say that they could afford seafood. Average working class people can usually not afford to buy seafood historically. So there was a sign system, a semiology of being able to buy a great big salmon or enough mahi-mahi for your 20-person dinner. And what we've learned now, and just do your research, we have literally by having, we have fished out, made endangered every major ocean fishing hole in the world. Every one. Every single one. There might be some small pockets that have not yet been affected, but the major fishing holes, I think there's 20, 19 or 20. And that's because we had to continue taking and taking and taking. And we have rendered extinct and almost extinct most of the large marine mammals through this way of thinking and behavior. So what happens is that there's no check on this mode of having. You can never have too much money because there's somebody who's got more money and there's a house and address and a zip code that you can get. And so people idolize their wealth managers. The wealth manager right now is kind of a lieutenant of God, a lieutenant of God, because that person's going to tell you how to make more money, add more money to your bank account. But see the subtle twist there? You might not be able to see it if you don't listen. The subtle twist is that the abstract thinking of how many dollars you have in your bank account overrides the concrete business and reality of living. They're two different things. And we will see people, I see it all the time in my work, they'll make decisions because of the bank account having to reach a figure by a certain date. That's a totally alienated existence. That is a non-human. That's an alienated human. They're not living in the present at all. And because they're not living in the present at all, they're not giving. Their whole life is lived in fear and anxiety, fear and anxiety, fear and anxiety. It's what drives the bourgeoisie. It's what drives the tech worker. It's what drives the government, the governmental bureaucracy. It's what drives healthcare. It's what drives education in this country. Fear and anxiety. So another way to look at it would be to say, look, I live my life in a good way. I need to give more to others, more money, more time. I need to spend time every day giving to the other, not worrying about my fucking pool or my bank account, but to just get up in the morning early and give. Not abstractly about some abstract number, which means nothing, by the way. People fight over numbers. When in reality, we could be getting down to the real business of living, the concrete business of living. And this is what all programs of virtue and virtue ethics, both religious and non-religious, the world over, have pushed us to do, except that those religious groups in capitalist economies are regulated entirely by the semiology and the algorithm of capitalism. Any major religion right now is regulated in terms of the capitalistic having possessory self structure. Nazarita, I've talked too long. I want to kind of give the microphone back to you.
Not at all. It's pretty interesting. So So really what we're looking at in our current culture, which of course has been duplicated in the past, is a disparity between those who have and those who have not. We could divide it between people who are struggling and with having less money and rich people who have a lot of money. And that's really where the power struggle is in our current culture. Actually, it's been this way, and maybe that's a lesson for humans, what we're going through. But there was a recent dialogue with someone, and they were saying it's really interesting that they were working, and they heard that the higher ups in the company, all the heads, you know, the higher management, were going on a 2-week kind of sabbatical, which they were all getting together, and they were going out into a beautiful place, and they were unplugging technology. And they were saying that rich people can now afford to unplug from technology, unplug from their phones, unplug from all the day-to-day life, because they have the privilege of experiencing the now, to sitting with themselves in the present without the use of technology. While poor people rely on technology more and more, that if they didn't have technology, they wouldn't be able to get to work, they wouldn't be able to make a living. It's become this power struggle. And you were talking about new ideas and new ways of thinking. And I was thinking, in every age, there's this disruption of the sedimented ideas of people. It comes through music. It comes through art. If you look back, it's like in the current ideas of like music, beatnik music was looked upon like, oh my God, what's that? And then there was jazz, and then there was rock and roll. And these are disrupting current patterns. They're a new art. It's like art gets into a certain sedimented form, and then suddenly there's this new art form. And years ago, the new art form became graffiti. And then it was slowly accepted that graffiti could be sold as art. Like graffiti artists did these large paintings, which sold them to a lot of condos in New York, because it was really cool then to have graffiti paintings. So I find this really interesting that we look for the disrupting factors in current culture to see where the new is being is breaking through, is coming out, is disrupting these old ideas, old sedimented patterns, negative patterns, that there's always something struggling to break through that concrete to bring something new and better.
Well, thank you, Nazarita. Let's continue to start to develop a conversation about being itself in distinction with having, and we'll of course continue this next week. I'm thoroughly enjoying the conversation, Nazarita. Thank you. There's a famous expression that Immanuel Kant made famous too in the Western world, and that is, existence is not a predicate. So when you go back to your grade school grammar classes, you realize that there was this discussion in English class about a subject and a predicate. That's how you make a sentence. You know, Tommy throws the ball, or Tommy is running home. There's a subject predicate grammar. And being itself, this is a really curious shift. Being itself cannot be predicated. Being just is. And this is a very it's a very important philosophical conceptual move in our discussion. Because no matter what you make of yourself, no matter what you do, whatever predication people make of you, or the world makes of you, or you make of you, there is your existence. This is the domain of ontology. This is this is the, I'll call it a co-awareness of the awareness of whatever you're doing. Whatever you're doing is always companioned by a state of existence with a state of awareness. That's the level of being. It's a free-floating, spontaneous reservoir of awareness in the world, and it's layered below your ontic level of, say, personal identity or self-identity. And right now, it's very covered over. It's deep presence. And being itself, then, if it can't be predicated, it's an element of, or it's a region of, insurrection, dissolution. It's a realm of integrity. It's a realm of connection with the divine, connection with all life, which is shamanic. If you are a believer in a monotheistic God, it's a connection with God. But the point is all the great religious thinkers and philosophers of the self have considered this in some way, right? And there's a lot of ways to talk about it. But for the purposes of our discussion, it's the mode of my life that resists possession. It resists the possessory appetite. It resists consumption models. It resists capitalism and socialism. It resists anxiety and fear. It just is. Things just are. That is the realm of the movement between ontology and phenomenology. Things just are. And it's also a reservoir and a realm of great freedom, great liberation, and great moral development. Because what that means is I have an unlimited supply of fuel for transformative processes so that I don't have to be what I was yesterday. I can be something new and better today and tomorrow. This is the realm of my freedom. So in distinction to the repetition compulsion in which I constantly try to redo my former life. And if you think about that, it happens all too often. We try to redo things. In this realm, there's nothing to redo. There's only the new. And you can see how that is the realm of our freedom and our liberation. It's also the realm of love. It means whatever I did before is in the past. I take on a new job, a new career, new types of relationships, new ways of giving to the world, new understandings, but I allow that in myself. I'm looking at the clock and it looks like we're running out of time. Nazarita, any 20-second parting comments before we close? Okay, so I'm going to take us to the end today. We just have a few moments left. We're going to pick this up before. We're really going to dive into what being is, what it means to escape from the oppressions and suppressions of the possessory self and a maniacal capitalism that we live in right now. This is Kevin Boileau, Nazarita Goldhammer, host of Epis Radio, wishing you all a wonderful day, a wonderful week, and we'll be with you next Tuesday. Be well.